From KUOW in Seattle, this is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. Today on the show, we're broadcasting the live conversation I had with Ghost Herd reporter and host Anna King and producer Matt Martin. The conversation first streamed online on Friday. Ghost Herd is a six-part podcast series from KUOW and Northwest Public Broadcasting. It brings listeners to the farmlands of the Columbia Basin as Anna uncovers what prompted Cody Easterday, a ranching tycoon with international recognition, to pull a cattle swindle that cost two companies almost $250 million. Anna's been following the story for years. And here's your warning. This conversation will include some spoilers for the podcast series. So if you haven't heard Ghost Herd already, head over to ghostherd.org or look it up on your favorite podcast app to listen. I started by asking Anna how it feels to finally have all six episodes of Ghost Herd out for listeners to hear.
It feels really awesome to knock that one out of the gate at the number six. And, you know, the best part is just this community reaction. I was on the phone with a potato seed grower in Montana the other day, and he was telling me how he knew the places we were writing about. He knew the territories and the roads and the intersections that I was talking about. And it's just really gratifying that both people in the city and people in rural areas appreciated this show. And we also got calls from folks in London, England, and a class in Norway is actually listening to the podcast as part of their coursework.
Oh, that's so cool. I love to hear that. I've loved the podcast. I know everybody here at KUOW is so proud of you and all the work that you and your team have been doing. And here is key member of your team, Ghost Herd producer Matt Martin, here with us. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Libby. Thanks for having me.
So same question for you. How does it feel to have Ghost Herd finished?
Yeah, it's a bit surreal because, you know, we spent 6 months working on this podcast. Those, you know, full-time job, 6 months, and like 2.5 months of that was just writing and editing and rewriting and editing again. And just like at the end of that time of writing, I was like so done to be like looking at these scripts. So, but like it was all worth it to see this, like Anna was saying, like the community reaction, how much people are responding to it, made it all worth it.
Yeah. Well, Anna, it feels like the place to start is back with episode one, when you and Matt went to the rodeo in Basin City. Why was it important for you that the story start with the rodeo?
Well, it was Matt's idea to go to the rodeo, and I didn't need much convincing. You know, once I grew up in a rodeo town called Roy, Washington, and rodeos are like where far-flung neighbors slap hands and see their neighbors. And it's just a chance for the community to exchange information. And so I knew that we would really have a good time if we went to the rodeo, but also that we would get a sense of this community. And it's right for this story to start in a place of gravity, in a place that centers the whole story, which is this community event, the rodeo.
But I understand the whole trip almost didn't happen, right? What's that about?
Yeah, we almost didn't get in. We drove up in two cars. I was in front and Matt was in back with his car. And we kind of were in the line to get in the parking lot. And they were kind of like, oh, you're with the media. And I was trying to talk my way in and say, hey, I would really like to go to this rodeo. And then Matt saw one of his bro-in-law's brother-in-law, and they let us in, and it meant all the world for us to be able to capture this whole event. And it was really something. Matt gave him a big bear hug, and then they waved us on in.
Are you telling me it wasn't all your sweet talking, Anna?
I can do some sweet talking, but Matt's bear hug got us through the gate.
Matt, what are your connections to this area of Eastern Washington? I mean, why were you able to get access and Anna was, you know, running up against a brick wall?
Yeah, I mean, it's just by sheer luck. I mean, I grew up in Yakima, so I'm from Eastern Washington. And my sister married the son of a farmer from Basin City. And just happened to be that the person that was parking cars that day, like Anna said, was my brother-in-law's brother-in-law, you know, and so just walked up and I just like stuck my head out of the car and I was like, Chris. And, you know, that was the key connection to get us into the rodeo.
Yeah. You got over the skepticism that media was getting, understandably. What was it like to be reporting on somewhere so close to home, Matt?
You know, honestly, like it was a lot of pressure to tell this story because, you know, my family's from Eastern Washington. That side of the state, you know, is more conservative. And my family is, you know, more on the conservative side. And I'm kind of like the black sheep of my family. Like, you know, I moved to Seattle. I work for public radio, you know, the media, the mainstream media. And so, like, I really wanted to get this story right for, like, my family and for other people on that side of the Cascades to understand that, like, you know, we're here to tell a fair story. We want to get the story right, and we want to represent this community well. So there's a lot of pressure to make sure that, you know, we could do that.
Mm. Did you tell your family and friends what you were working on from back home? And how did they feel? Were they supportive?
Yeah, they were really excited. I think people in that community, you know, just like anyone else, like, this is a good story and people are curious and they want to know the details and they want to know what happened. So everyone was really excited. Everyone that I talked to, my family and other friends out there, were excited that we were going to kind of dig into this. But at one point, my brother-in-law pulled me aside and he was like, you know, like, you have a responsibility to, like, tell this story and to make his community not look bad.
Mm. How did that make you feel, Matt?
Yeah, it felt, like I said, like, you know, there was a lot of pressure there. But I didn't want to disappoint him. Because, yeah, there is, I feel like there is a lot of misunderstanding. And I think this is something that, you know, Anna will talk about more. But, like, there's a divide, I feel like, between, like, the western side of the state and the eastern side of the state. And so try to, like, kind of, I felt like I was in a good position in that, like, I came from that world, but I now kind of live in the western side of the state, and so kind of can speak both languages a little bit.
Mm. There's a lot of pressure. Anna and Matt, you know, that was kind of a constant struggle, right? It was hard to get folks to talk to you or to open up, especially about Cody.
Yeah, you know, this community is so tight-knit. You know, like I said in the podcast, it could hold a tide of Columbia River water back. And in a way, you know, the Easterdays were kind of like this popular kid in school. They're like nobody wants to speak against them. And so getting people to speak was really, really difficult. And I thought, you know, given all that has happened, I was surprised that the community was still so quiet about the details. And even though they would tell me a lot of interesting things off record, but eventually people would drop a document here. They would give me a hint there. And we started to piece things together.
Mm. How about you, Matt?
Yeah. It was interesting. You know, I was doing pre-interviews before we ever started recording and talking to people. And when you get people on the phone and ask them about Cody, you know, it'd be like, oh, well, Cody this, he lied about this. He had a bad deal, or he lied to me, didn't give me the money that I was owed, and all these stories. So people had a lot of opinions to talk about Cody. But then once you ask, like, oh, well, can we interview you? They were just like, clam up. They didn't want to go on record. They didn't want to be recorded. So it was, I feel like that was the hardest part of this, was trying to understand Cody and, like, show him as a character without really having people that were willing to go on the record about it.
Yeah. And Cody wasn't going to talk to you directly. You mentioned in the podcast that you tried to leave a letter for him on his porch, but that didn't work out. Right, Anna?
Yeah, and that was kind of the penultimate thing that we did. But, you know, we sent registered letters. I emailed his lawyer. We called. We kept a detailed spreadsheet of all the ways that we had tried to contact him, just to make sure that I didn't want to harass him, of course, but I did want the family to know that I was putting this story together. And if they did want to speak about it, I was open and welcoming their story. And then at the last ditch effort, I told Matt and Megan Farmer, our photographer, I said, we really got to go up to their house and just drop a letter on the porch or try to deliver it just to make ultimate sure that we did not leave anything on the table when we tried to get their story. And so eventually we are in front of the driveway and I'm kind of sweating bullets. And Matt and Megan are like, I don't know if we should be doing this. And so we're coming up to the driveway and I'm in the front seat next to Matt. He's driving. We're creeping down the driveway. I'm looking for guns and dogs. Matt's saying, I ain't getting out of the car. And Megan's cowering in the back with her camera. And I'm like looking at those two and I'm like, come on, you guys. And they're like, you go. And so I walk up to the porch and I honest to goodness have almost been eaten by dogs before in my reporting work, and so that was what I was most scared of. But this little old lazy dog kind of waddled out from the back and looked at me as I dropped that letter on the porch after nobody answered the door, and then we took off. And you know, we certainly didn't want to harass the family at all, but we did want them to know that we welcome their side of the story.
Yeah. But the message at that point, with all the different ways you tried to contact, seemed to be clear. They weren't going to talk to you. And I want to go deeper on that because it seems like that would make for a really difficult challenge in telling this story. I mean, how do you make something when you can't talk to the key figure, the person who drives the narrative here, Cody? And by the way, nobody wanted to talk about Cody either. I mean, what challenges and how do you get around those challenges in making this podcast?
Well, I've reported out here, Libby, for a couple of decades, and I've earned this trust of my sources, and I've talked to a lot of sources off the record. And, you know, Matt was also really key in getting a few sources that we had never talked to on the record. And we were able to go through some of those new sources to his family and really try to kind of draw from that well new people. For instance, one of the first episodes that we had a person who is his bro-in-law's uncle.
Yeah, and it was, so that, you know, my family connection was really helpful in that, yeah, it got us a few interviews that we probably couldn't have gotten any other way. And that uncle, I was doing a pre-interview with him, and we had a date set for the interview, and then he mentioned, like, yeah, like, I'm excited to talk about this. Like, there's been, and, you know, he knows some of the members of the Easter Day family and is friends with some of the members of the family, and he was like, yeah, like, there's been some bad reporting on this from, like, the Easter Days were upset about some reporting, and then he was like, yeah, it's like this woman named Anna King. And like my heart just like dropped and I froze. And I was like, oh, no. I was like, that's who I'm working with. Mm. And I want to be clear, like, not bad reporting in that Anna's stories were incorrect. But just, you know, he had heard from the Easter Days that they were upset about Anna King, who was reporting all of these stories on the family. And I thought for sure that we were going to lose the interview. Like, I was like, there's no way he's going to want to talk to us anymore. Like, no one is talking to us. He's not going to want to talk to us either. Then I called him up a few days later and just, I don't know why he was cool with it, but he still was like, yeah, come on out. Like, happy to do the interview. Didn't have to give him the hard sell. So for whatever reason, very glad, because he was like one of the only people that really was able to kind of give some color to Cody and his family.
This is Soundside. I'm Libby Dankman, and we'll hear more from my conversation with Ghost Herds, Anna King, and Matt Martin right after this break on KUOW. Welcome back to Soundside. I'm Libby Dankman. Today, we're airing my conversation with Ghost Herd reporter and host Anna King and producer Matt Martin. Anna and Matt spent months taking a deeper look into the story of Cody Easterday, a ranching legend who was eventually sentenced to 11 years in federal prison for one of the largest cattle scams in U.S. history. As a warning, this conversation does include some spoilers for the podcast series. If you haven't listened to Ghost Herd yet, and you should, head over to ghostherd.org to find every episode and to check out some incredible photos by KUOW photojournalist Megan Farmer. Anna says this series reflects the decades she's spent building relationships and trust among rural communities east of the Cascades. One of those people Anna turned to is Daryl Miles, a wheat rancher in Franklin County. Here's Anna.
Daryl is a great guy. And, you know, I grew up on a ranch in the shadow of Mount Rainier. And so I rode my bike a quarter of a mile down a dirt road to, like, feed the horses and the cattle, to knock ice out of the troughs. And I've spent the rest of my life, about 20 years out here in the Columbia Basin. And so what I really wanted to do is see if these folks that I was meeting in the field could kind of give me breadcrumbs to follow, if they could kind of show me the story. And for instance, this Daryl Miles that you're seeing a picture of, he basically was a guy I met when I was on a hike out near Juniper Dunes Wilderness, and he was burning piles of tumbleweeds. And I just randomly stopped and started talking to him one day. And we talked about farming for a while. And then years later now, he has become a source on the Easter Day Story. So those are the kinds of connections that have really helped tell this story. It's just the long time that I've spent out here and have developed these sources.
Hmm. And we also have a listener question about that. Anonymous is interested, considering how hard it was to get people to talk to you for Ghost Herd, has the series impacted your journalistic relationship with any of your contacts or sources?
You know, I would say, I used to talk to Cody Easterday on the telephone. I don't know that he would talk to me now. You know, I don't know. I think it's hard to have a story told about you, especially one that you might not agree with. But other sources that are in this story, I've talked to them throughout the whole process of this podcast and after it aired, each part. And so they're kind of shy about being on the podcast, on being on the radio, but they really feel like they were fairly represented. And that's really gratifying that they still talk to me, they still trust me, even after they've heard all of the hard work that we've done.
Yeah. What is that added pressure like, though, that I can hear in both of your voices, Anna and Matt, when you're telling that story in a place where you are so deeply connected and you don't just helicopter in the way a lot of journalists who are maybe coming in from different outlets, national outlets especially, would have to do? You know these people, you're connected to them, and you want to maintain these connections going forward. What is that extra pressure like?
You know, this story is partially a love letter to the place that I've lived since I've been in my 20s here. And it's a story about the dwindling desert landscape that we're seeing around us. It's about the freshness of alfalfa wafting through your open window in the summer when it's first cut. It's about the tick, tick, tick of the irrigation pivot lines. And I just wanted our listeners to, like, discover this place and to feel the poetry of it.
Hmm. You know, I've gotten a question, a listener question that's kind of related to this. So I just want to shout out somebody asking, how has the podcast been received in the community? Matt, you have some information about that, right?
Yeah. I mean, so far I've received positive feedback. My brother-in-law, who gave me that, like, lecture, or not lecture, but, like, cautioned me about representing his community well, after the fourth episode that starts with Nicole Berg, the wheat farmer, and she talks about her grandfather not liking modern cabs because you got to eat dirt to be a good farmer. I got a text from my brother-in-law saying that he just busted up laughing when he read that or heard that part, because his own grandfather actually removed the air conditioning and radio from their tractor that they got because he felt like it was too distracting, that, you know, you didn't need those things to be out there farming. And he said, like, he just said that rings so true. Mm. And, like, he felt that, like, you know, so I felt like when I got that text from him, I was like, okay, like, I feel like I nailed it. I feel like I did the good job of representing the community well. So it was very satisfying to get that text.
Yeah, you're hitting a chord there. Before we go any further, let's answer another listener question. Could you explain a bit more about the missing 265,000 cattle? Wouldn't Cody eventually have to provide this number of cattle at the slaughterhouse? I thought he only recouped his cost when the animal was slaughtered. So I still don't understand how he defrauded Tyson of nearly $250 million.
Yeah, that's a great question, Libby. And basically, for the listener, what's happening is that the Tyson gives money to Cody when Cody purchases new cattle, baby cattle, like little calves. And so he was inflating his numbers of those calves, and then he was feeding them on paper. So he was charging Tyson for their care and upkeep along the way. And then he just never finished that final part, which was bringing them to the kill plant because they didn't exist. So he was getting money for the upfront cost, and then he was getting money for the care and feeding. And that's how he did the swindle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the part, the money up front, that is kind of key to that situation. It's not just that he gets paid on slaughter. It's that he gets paid up front and for the care and feeding throughout. That's helpful, Anna. This is really inherently a story about land and the people who work it and the dedication that they have to the land. We hear over and over from people about how connected they feel to their work and where they live. Like this story from Nicole Berg, a fourth-generation farmer who lives just south of Basin City. Here's Nicole talking about her grandfather, his connection to the farmland he toiled over, even impacted his burial, in fact.
Oh, yeah, and he even got a pine box. It wasn't a casket. It was a pine box that he wanted to be put in. And I remember a call from my dad and my mom. Hey, can you go downstairs and bring us down some pillows and some blankets to put in this pine box for Grandpa? Because it's literally just a pine box, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah. He wanted to be back in the dirt.
Nicole's grandfather's connection to the land even impacted his burial there. But that land is changing hands now. As you report in Ghost Herd, large investors like the Latter-day Saints are purchasing ag property. We saw this happen when Cody's land went up for sale. Here's Addy Candib, Pacific Northwest Regional Director at American Farmland Trust. Here's what they had to say about access to land in our region.
The Easterday Ranch properties traded hands at about $17,500 per acre, which is well above that average price, right? And we know that access to land is the single biggest hurdle facing beginning farmers who want to farm. And at that price that was paid for the Easterday Ranch, even if you're just talking about a smaller scale direct market operation, that price per acre becomes so cost prohibitive as to make it next to impossible for new and beginning farmers to get started, or for small existing family scale operations to acquire more land or to compete.
So where does that leave farmers now? Are there any protections or support systems in place for small farmers?
Yeah, Libby, farming's largely just a gamble. There are insurance programs for sure, and they can help kind of mitigate some of the risk of farming. So if you have a bad crop, that they could protect. But a lot of farmers tell me, like, if you insured all of your crops all of the time, you're never going to make enough money to stay in business. So you have to accept some risk. And there just aren't so many family farmers that can control all of the things that fly at them, like rainwater or bugs or diseases or international trade problems. So it's just all a gamble.
We have a listener question that's come in during the event here from Ruthie. Anna, you speak a lot in the podcast about corporations taking over farmland and that financial pressure on modern day farmers. Do you think that this situation was partially the cause of Cody's desperate choice?
You know, it's hard to get into the head of Cody Easterday and say what caused him to gamble and then what caused him to make this fraud. But I would imagine that the pressure of any large business could be maybe too great for somebody. This family farmed on a scale where they had a private jet, they had a packing shed in Florida, they had a ranch in Idaho, they had one of the largest dairies in Oregon. Now, even one of those operations would be a lot to manage, but when you put it all together, it's just a lot of pressure. But thank you for the question.
We should be clear, too, that Cody's land was passed down. He wasn't a smaller farmer trying to break in the way that some of the folks you talked to are. I do want to pivot here and talk about how wild the Latter-day Saints role is in this story. You spoke with Betsy Gaines Quammen, who's an environmental historian who specializes in Mormon settlement and public land conflicts, about why the LDS Church is involved with land purchasing at all. And Betsy says it's not just for theological reasons.
In the 60s, two things happened. There was a focus on acquiring assets, and the church became $32 million in debt, and there was a focus on becoming less transparent. So they're famous for being elusive about how much they're worth and their assets.
Matt, what was it like digging into that part of the story? Was it surprising to learn about the LDS's connection to the area?
Well, actually, not for me personally, because I grew up in the LDS Church, so I kind of already knew a lot of what kind of the land purchases and kind of that aspect. I knew that they already owned a lot of farms, but so this was one of my kind of personal little favorite parts of telling this story, and it was in. I think when we wrote the first draft of this, this LDS section was probably twice as long as it ended up being in the actual episode. Just because, like, I was like, yeah, we got to tell the whole history of everything. And that clip that you played kind of gets more into a little bit more of, like, the LDS history. Because they, you know, it's not just theological reasons, but there is also theological reasons, so it's kind of both. And so we didn't quite we decided that, like, going deep in the history was maybe a little too much information that people needed. But I think it's interesting that it was really, you know, in, like, that clip that you played, in the 60s the church was, like, almost bankrupt, and then they kind of made this pivot of making investments. Like, we need a way to make money, and so they started these investments, and now they're just this massive organization that owns land everywhere. And I feel like when I tell people this story, that is one of the things that I think people kind of react to the most, of just how it's just surprising, like, how big this is.
We got a question from Aaron on this line of thinking. Any sense, Aaron says, of what the Mormon Church intends to do with that incredible piece of land? Either Matt or Anna want to take that?
Well, they're going to farm it. They're going to farm, a lot of high-value crops. And it's prime Columbia River senior water rights, and they can grow crops that are more stable, like orchards or vineyards, but they could also grow high value crops like potatoes in that ground. And I think the interesting thing too is just that is an area that might expand into city one day. It might be an expansion of Kennewick. And so that water would be very, very valuable for possible development in the future. So no matter which way they turn that land, it'll probably keep its value or just increase in value.
That was Anna King, the host and reporter behind KUOW and Northwest Public Broadcasting's podcast series, Ghost Herd. You're listening to Soundside. We'll be right back after this break. Back with more Soundside on KUOW, I'm Libby Denkman. The relationship between farmers and the land they labor over isn't the only connection reporter Anna King and producer Matt Martin explore in their podcast, Ghost Herd. The series also considers the connection between Indigenous communities and the land that was stolen from them. Listeners meet Bobby Connor, the head of the Temuscht Cultural Institute. It's the only museum along the Oregon Trail that tells the story of Western expansion from a tribal point of view. For the final episode of Ghost Herd, Bobby brought Anna to a feast. The audio didn't make the final cut of the series, but we're going to hear it now. Here's Bobby.
So the food's on the table when they're set at feast. You know, water is the first thing we take and the last thing we take a sip of. But a taste of the salmon, a taste of the various fishes, a taste of the various meats, a taste of the various roots, and a taste of the various berries are all done as a sacrament to remember the law that sustains our people, which is that if they take care of us, we have to take care of them in their home. That's a covenant we have with everything else that lives here, and a covenant with the Creator that gave us this fabulous place to live.
Hmm. Anna, what's happening in that tape?
I could listen to Bobby Connor weave stories all day long, and we spent a lot of time with Bobby to bring this podcast. But what she's saying is she's talking about how Native Americans in the Washit religion and across the Northwest, they honor these traditional sister and brother foods that come into season throughout the year. The wild celery, the roots, the salmon, the elk, the deer, the huckleberries. And Armin Minthorn, a spiritual and religious leader on the Umatilla Reservation, told me, it's kind of similar to when people go to Catholic church and they receive communion, and that these small tastes of berries or roots or deer and elk, that they are actually for Native Americans like the deceased bodies and hearts of their family members, that they are seeing their relatives come back to them in these foods, and that they're honoring them so that they can go forward. Mm-hmm. And I've been to many of these ceremonies and to these religious bell ringing and singing ceremonies, and it's just amazing, the cacophony of sound, of the bell ringing back and forth, the drumming, the singing, and the joy of bringing these foods back into the world each year in a seasonal round, in a seasonal rhythm. It's just really wonderful to witness.
Matt, how did you think about incorporating the stories and perspectives of Native people in Ghost Herd?
Yeah, I mean, that was an intentional thing that we wanted to do from the very beginning of this. And during the summer, so I spent probably like 3 to 4 weeks of the summer out in eastern Washington with Anna, you know, reporting these stories. And I was talking with my sister while I was out there. And I was like, oh, yeah, we're going down to the Umatilla Reservation to interview Bobby. And my sister was kind of confused. Like, she's like, what does that have to do with the story of the Easter Days? And I feel like that was a good opportunity for me to kind of like explain why it is connected. And, you know, like, kind of like Easter Day is kind of like the flashy, exciting story to get people listening. But like, really, we wanted to tell a different story. Like, we wanted to tell a story of the land and what's happening in this region and the history and the power of land. Because, you know, one of the central themes that we tried to focus on is like the value of dirt and like who owns land has power. And so if you're telling that story of the land, like you have to tell the story of the people that originally owned this land.
Yeah. I mean, the last 10 years is just a tiny infinitesimal slice of what has happened on this land. How does the story of Native people intersect with what we're currently seeing as these large corporations purchase land that was previously owned by farmers and before that was, of course, the home of Native people? How does it fit in that broader timeline and tapestry?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think of it as a bit of like history repeating itself. Like, I feel like we're just witnessing another big transfer of land ownership. And, you know, I think we used the phrase in the series of like, you know, the new corporate settlers are coming in. So we had the original settlement of this land, and now we're seeing another big transfer with this new set of settlers.
We received an interesting listener question from Anonymous, and they say, my husband and I look forward to each episode of Ghost Herd, but I think we hear different things in it. I am a longtime 40-plus year vegetarian for humane reasons. When I heard in the last episode when you said that cows grow too big for the saws in slaughterhouses, I cringed. My husband, a carnivore, did not. I'm curious, when you were producing these episodes, how did you think about how the series would or would not cover the issue of how cows are raised and killed in this country? Anna?
I think that's a really good question. And obviously, we were hoping to reach the broadest audience possible and to really have things in the story for each person that listened to us. And so it is a tough subject. How cattle are slaughtered is not sometimes even breakfast talk. So you just need to think about all of the parts of the podcast. And it is a fact of life that there are cattle raised and killed in our country. And so to learn more about that is, I think, to become educated about the food system that we operate within. And so if we can just learn about all aspects of our life and the earth and where we live, I think we're better off. And even if it's a little bit hard to hear. And I did really consider what she's talking about because, you know, the way that our food systems have grown so large is something that I didn't even understand as well at the beginning of this podcast as I understand now. To see the whole scale of our food system up close and personal was really surprising to me. So thank you so much for that question.
For me, that question also really highlighted this issue of perspective. You know, in rural communities, these cows are a livelihood. Their raising and slaughter represents a payday for ranchers. But for some listeners, especially when we're talking about NPR folks in maybe, you know, larger cities and suburbs, that idea may seem jarring, thinking about cattle growing too big for the slaughter, for saws, and how problematic that can be. Matt and Anna, maybe you can both weigh in on this. How did you think about how the story would land with people in farming communities versus us city folks?
I wanted to get the difference between a hackamore and a halter right, between a filly and a heifer right in this piece, so that people in the rural towns would know that we knew what we were talking about and that we paid attention to the details. And it was funny during the podcast, you know, the making of it, we would often have these discussions, Libby, about, well, what is that? And how does a tractor work? Or why do the tires wear out? Why don't they just use the same tires? And I'd have to like find myself explaining these things, but it made me sharper because as we had to explain it, then I could then translate that to the West Side audience or to a city audience. And Matt and the whole team would ask really great questions to help elicit kind of what I had in my head about rural life. And we wanted to reflect this story to an urban audience, but also be true with grit in the rural areas.
Libby, I cannot tell you how many times Anna had to correct me when I used like the wrong, like that is not a cow. That is a, I don't know, a whatever.
Steer.
Yeah. Like how dare you use the wrong word? So it was a big education for me in like making sure we like were using the right words and representing, you know, these cows and this culture and community correctly.
Yeah. I don't know if I said you dare though, Matt.
Matt dares. There's a question kind of about the direction, editorial direction of the podcast here. I'm going to slot in from a listener. It's a question from Matt, in fact. Tyson isn't exactly a sympathetic victim. Tyson, the meat company. Matt would like to know more about your choice not to go deeper into the relationship between Tyson and the Easter Days. Anna, you have any thoughts about that?
I think, you know, we were largely writing from documents, from the bankruptcy documents, from litigation documents, from what we could glean from my sources. So yeah, I mean, I'm open to a next chapter if we can write more about that relationship between the Tysons and the Easterdays. Tyson did grant me one off the record conversation. It lasted, I think, around 30 minutes, and it was really brief. And so we took what we could do. And to my knowledge, Tyson really hasn't opened up to another reporter either. Mm. So, you know, you sometimes are handed the information that you can work with, and that's what you do.
And that must be frustrating, because if it's off the record, you know, the conversation happens, the information that they might tell you in that conversation might be very pertinent to the story, but you can't use it. And they know, they're constrained by all kinds of their own, you know, legal team in their ears. But it's really hard when you have to navigate those kinds of corporate bureaucracies when it comes to answering basic questions about a case. I mean, I can imagine that was frustrating, Anna.
Yeah, but you know, we had spreadsheets full of just questions, Matt and I. We would type these questions into a spreadsheets and we would try to go about hunting down the answers. This story is like an octopus. It has so many different arms coming out. There wasn't any shortage of interesting material to work with. It's just that some questions still remain, and I'm open to the next chapter.
Well, this story ends with Cody Easterday's sentencing. Anna, you were there when his family and friends gathered. What was it like to be in that courtroom?
You know, Matt and I walked up to the courthouse steps, and we got inside, and we opened this door that went into this corridor. And inside there were packed like dozens and dozens of people. And they were all standing in lines along the walls, and we kind of edged our way inside. And I got really nervous just waiting there for the court proceedings to begin. And then eventually we all filed into the courthouse, and there wasn't an open seat. Every seat was filled. And they even brought in chairs and wheeled them across the courtroom to put a couple more people on the side. And we sat right behind Debbie Easterday and her children as they watched Cody be sentenced and give his testimony. And, you know, when he gave his testimony, their sons just leaned down on their knees and they just were rocking back and forth. And they were just obviously so upset. And Debbie just patted one of them on the back. And, you know, you could just tell that these kids, they're grown-ups, but they're still kids, and they just really cared about what was happening to their father. And it was really terrifying to be in that room, actually, because I knew that I had spent more than a year investigating their life and their community and the crimes that Cody committed. And so to be so physically close to them, I was really worried about it. When they came out of the courthouse, you know, we tried to have interviews with them. I approached Debbie. I said, "Debbie," and she came up to me and she said, don't even, right in my face. And so I didn't want to harass her. So I just backed up and I, you know, backed off. But it was really a tough go. It was a tough day.
Why was that worrying for you, Anna? Can you kind of explore that feeling? What was in your heart at that moment when you're in that courtroom and you're so close to the people that are affected by Cody's scam?
I think it comes from being a rural person. You know, I'm a rural person. I grew up that way. And I have empathy for Cody. As tough as this crime is and as tough as what he did is, it's still, you know, he's still a human. And there were people that said, you know, in our story, people said, "I don't care who you are. You got to have justice for what you've done." And then there's others that are saying, yeah, he's just a guy. You know, he's just a father. He's just a man at the end of the day. And this is a tough go to have 11 years in a federal penitentiary.
Matt, do you have any reflections on being in the courtroom?
Yeah, I think for me, I don't know if I have much empathy for Cody. I have a lot of empathy for his family and the people that are affected by his actions. You know, like his, you know, he made the decisions that he made, but you know, his family, his mother, his children, those people. And that's what I felt in the courtroom, was just like feeling the energy that those people were giving off in that moment of just, you know, my father's going to be gone for the next 11 years. Like, that's kind of what I was feeling. And it's very like, yeah, like it was very just kind of like, you're a witness to the, like someone else's tragedy. It's kind of just, it's weird to be in that physical space.
Yeah. Jan wrote in, Anna, with a question about how you shared perspective from Cody's wife. It says, the question says, you know, what kind of contact did you have with Cody's wife? Because you mentioned her perspective from time to time. I'm gathering you didn't have direct contact. How did you try to share that perspective?
Debbie wrote an extensive letter to the court pleading for her husband's sentence to be lighter than it evidently was. And it was a heartbreaking letter. And we drew heavily from her own writing to reflect how she felt about the whole deal. And I wish I could have sat down with her and had an interview. And I still welcome that interview if she would like to have it. Because I feel like to talk about a family and a crime so extensively, I really owe it to them to tell their side of the story if they ever want to come forward.
Matt, I hear that Ghost Herd was actually pushed back a couple of months because of last minute information that you received. What was that information and how did it change the story?
Yeah, it was like Anna said, we, you know, that letter that Anna mentioned from Debbie was in a court document, and we had pretty much finished our scripts. Like, the scripts were pretty much done, and we were supposed to release in November. But then when the trial happened, and we got a bunch of new court documents that we didn't have before, and Debbie's letter was just one of many. There was probably like a 40 or 50 page court document that was just full of letters from family members and friends, you know, trying to, there were letters to the judge to say why Cody deserved a light sentence. And then there was also documents from the Tyson officials. So it was all this information that we didn't have before. And that really helped us fill in the gap. Because we didn't get those interviews with the people that know Cody in the community, these court documents helped us fill in those gaps. So we really just had to go back and rewrite like all of the episodes, and we pushed, you know, the release back till after the holidays, but really gave us a lot of information that we didn't have before.
Yeah. Anna and Matt, you spoke to Justin Farrell, a Yale professor and author of the book Billionaire Wilderness, while you were making the podcast, and we have a clip of what Justin told you.
The West has always sort of been this place of possibility, this place of endless optimism, especially for settlers. This frontier idea that kind of pushed people outward toward the West, that underwrote this idea of manifest destiny and the sense of building a nation. And I wonder, with where we're at as a country, how that will shift the West, and what that will become. What sorts of myths will replace the myths of old?
Has telling this story changed how you think about the West, what it means, where it's heading?
I'll take a stab at it here.
It's a big question.
you know, I think what happened for me on this podcast is I've been reporting on agriculture for years, as I've said, but this opened a new window for me to see the true scale of how agriculture has become, and that everything was public in this bankruptcy, in the Easterday bankruptcy, and we could see how much the land sold for, and we could talk to some of the players who were there, and that we knew, you know, how these cattle deals were made, and that we could see the whole scale of it just a lot more clearly. I just think that we have all these questions about the West now. Who do we want to own the West? Is the story we tell ourselves about the West still the one that we want to tell? Is it still very much unwritten?
That was Anna King, the host and reporter of Ghost Herd, KUOW and Northwest Public Broadcasting's latest podcast series, as well as Ghost Herd producer Matt Martin. All 6 episodes of Ghost Herd are available to stream now on ghostherd.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And that's it for Soundside today. The show was produced by Sarah Leibovitz and Noel Gaska, with editing by Jed Kim. And special thanks to our KUOW events team who helped make this live show possible. Hans Twite is our marketing audio-video producer. Robert Jacob Springer is our broadcast technician. Amelia Peacock is our marketing communications manager. Daphne Liu is our events producer. And Charlotte Durin is KUOW's events and partnerships manager. Soundside will be back tomorrow with new stories right here on KUOW.